So today I'm going to discuss the issue of competition between charge stripe order and high temperature superconductivity in cuprates. So after a brief introduction, I will discuss the nature of the so-called spin gap phase, and then introduce a hypothesis of intrinsic transition temperature of superconducting single layers, bilayers, and then how experiment actually seems to support this hypothesis, and also some theoretical considerations. Then I will have a very brief critique about stripe as a mechanism of superconductivity. Then discuss some of the experimental observations, some very striking observation. Already you heard about these things in the talk by Lockwell 2 weeks back. Some of these experimental strong dependence of transition temperature on epitaxial strain. So let me summarize my talk before I begin with a picture. Then I will. See, I'm not prepared. So this is a summary of my talk. Stripes confined. So when the experimental activity as well as theoretical activity in cuprate superconducted started, everything looked very rosy and nice. And in fact, initiated by Anderson's original proposals, one had a very nice, what I call as a dream phase diagram. And if things are very simple, you start with a quantum state, namely a Mott insulator, which in fact is the so-called resonating valence bond state. And which Anderson called as preformed neutral singlet pairs. There is a good quantum resonance. And then you dope the system by removing some carriers. So the pre-existing singlets start moving and transporting charges, and you get superconductivity. So this was the original proposal that Anderson wrote down in his science paper, which had been underlying model and many beautiful notions that became important slowly with time. But as always, there is difference between dream and reality. In fact, historically, this was very soon, kind of realized, and again a dream theory, some kind of mean field theory, wherein you get a very large transition temperature as a function of doping. And it was argued that the quantum fluctuations will reduce TC and make it look like what you see experimentally. But what is reality now? You get a feeling of that, for example, if you look at this phase diagram that actually came from Imai using NQR results, that if you take lanthanum copper oxide with strontium doping, if you look at it as a function of hole concentration X, you find not only is there superconductivity, there is an additional order which is related to charge stripe correlation, some kind of frozen charge density wave developing in the system at a higher transition temperature scale at lower hole concentration. And of course, below this, you have antiferromagnetism. So one has to explain how the system becomes superconducting in spite of the fact that you had antiferromagnetism and you have this charge density wave or charge stripes, and you get, how do you get high temperature superconductivity? If one wants to look at the nature of charge stripe order, okay, just to give you a feeling for this charge stripes, basically what happens is the following. Before that, let me make some very general statement. Charge stripes are very common in perovskites. I mean, we see this in plenty in manganites and other perovskites. Wherever you have octahedra and Antler effect, octahedra can rotate and they can distort and can very easily localize charges. In cuprates, you see the following kind of charge stripe order experimentally. What you see experimentally is that the holes organize themselves preferentially along this one-dimensional lines. So in a sense, this is like a Mott insulating region, this is like a conducting region. In a very simple caricature, it looks as if this is quarter-filled band, that is, there is half electron per site along this, and then this is one electron per site, so it's like Mott insulator. So it alternates in this particular fashion, and experimentally you see the wave vector, stripe wave vector, has this particular form. It is not exactly linear, it has some complicated non-linear relation. But that it is a stripe is seen very clearly when you look at neutron scattering result. That, for example, this is the so-called spin stripe Bragg spots, which is coming from a spin order that is superimposed on this charge modulation. You can imagine that this region is more insulating, so it tries to recover some antiferromagnetic order. This also recovers antiferromagnetic order. But however, there is a domain wall as you walk across. So you can convince yourself that this will lead to two types of Bragg spots displaced about pi along the y and x axis. And the position of the Bragg spot moves like this. If you want to get some kind of real space picture and how these wave vectors come, this is how it looks. In essence, you have this insulating stripe and conducting stripe. If you freeze these holes, one hole in every alternate side in the stripe, you can imagine further antiferromagnetic order, which will lead to a wave vector for spin order, which is 1/8 roughly in this particular fashion. Anyway, this is not and the stripes are something now that is very clearly seen experimentally. It was theoretically predicted by Jan Zanon and collaborators, and Heinz-Schulz, Emery, and lot of work from Santa Barbara, from Doug Scalapino's group have come. So there are many interesting theoretical and experimental work. For example, if you take one of the recent experimental results in oxygen-doped lanthanum copper oxide, you see, even in the superconducting state, very well-developed spin-stripe correlation. Once you have a spin-stripe, I think it is kind of taken for granted that there is an underlying charge modulation which is supporting this spin modulation. It is unlikely that spin-stripes exist independent of charge modulation. Okay, yeah, in some... in this system where there is a charge motion, yeah, I agree with you, in models it can happen. Yeah, this is polarized neutron scattering. What you see is the intensity of this Bragg various nearly elastic peaks with the correlation length of the order of few hundred angstrom units. There is some controversy about this experiment because there are apparently some staging phenomena, but what is striking is that this spin ordering starts developing along with superconducting order. In fact, the amplitude of the spin order parameter essentially follows superconducting order parameter. So which... Exactly, there is no elastic incommensurate peak. It goes up in energy above the transition temperature. This is some series of papers from Bob Bergenau's group. Okay, so stripes are realities. Now there are even more recent experiments, transport measurements and photo emission measurements, which indicate the presence of stripe correlation. So the gut feeling that one gets about this organization of holes is that in fact it should work against superconductivity, because any charge localization is sharpening of charge, so phase will fluctuate more and then superconductivity will be reduced. But however, it is argued by Kivilson and Emery and others that one should perhaps imagine in the following way that what this Mott insulating region provides is the source for spin gap, and then you have superconductivity along this channel, and then it is the presence of this spin gap which enhances singlets and then pairs from one chain can tunnel to other, and then you can get superconductivity. I will have a criticism about this model towards the end. So that is why it becomes important to discuss. Right, exactly, the pseudo gap. No, in lanthanum copper oxide, they correlate very well. Okay, the argument goes like this. In lanthanum copper oxide, you start seeing stripe at a few hundred degrees above this this ordered region. This is... right, okay, let me... I have a pointer. So the amount of stripe correlations definitely decrease as you go to higher doping. So presumably there are dynamical stripes in this particular region, which is a so-called pseudo gap region. So the TC star essentially comes down like this. So an argument is that it is this dynamical stripe which is responsible for the pseudo gap. Okay, experimentally, this is one of the striking experiments which tells about frozen stripes. But if you go to this region, there are some indications for stripes from transport measurements like this Hall angle. Because Hall angle has a power law dependence which deviates from, you know, other overdoped, well-doped cuprates. So that can say that you have stripes. Then if you look at neutron scattering, you start seeing this quasi-elastic neutron peaks all over this region, even above TC, which can, from that one can infer that perhaps there are stripes or stripe correlations. If you go to bilayer compound like IPCO, above the transition temperature or below TC, you see stripiness from this, again, this income insulate peaks. So it is some kind of ubiquitous, it is around. We have to live with it and explain, in spite of that, how superconductivity is happening. Okay. Now, I started thinking about this problem by looking at some of these experimental results in thallium material. It is remarkable that if you take this one-layer thallium material, where you have CuO2 planes which are well separated by thallium bilayers, you have now good single crystals, but they're small in size. Experiments are reproducible. The highest TC that you get is about 95 degree Kelvin. And if you look at the normal state transport properties, it is not distinguishable from lanthanum copper oxide or other material. And originally, I was also thinking, motivated by this interlayer pair tunneling model, that the difference between lanthanum copper oxide, which is also a single layer material, and thallium material is due to some kind of interlayer tunneling. But in the last 3 years, beautiful experiments have come out and told that actually the interlayer Josephson plasma frequency is not agreeing with interlayer tunneling, pair tunneling theory by a factor of, you know, 50 or 100, suggesting that there is indeed a one layer mechanism for superconductivity in thallium. Then if that be the case, then it is remarkable that for a same carrier concentration, let us say optimal carrier concentration, thallium material has 95 degree Kelvin TC and the lanthanum copper oxide has only 32 degree Kelvin TC or 35. One may say that disorder is playing some role, but I will argue that there is something else which is controlling the transition temperature and depressing it from a fairly large value. If you look at the quantum chemistry like exchange integral and the bandwidth, they do not change significantly, you know, by about 50% or 60% to account for this large difference between tantalum copper oxide and thallium material. So this is very striking. Now there are several other, in fact it is at this time it was brought to my attention by Phuon Ong, some very beautiful experimental result about which you heard 2 weeks back by Lokwe et al, that if you take lanthanum copper oxide and grow it on an epitaxy which produces some epitaxial strain by having appropriate lactase mismatch, you find a remarkable phenomena that the transition temperature goes all the way up to 50 degree Kelvin, even though the original transition temperature for that carrier concentration is about 25 degree or 20 degree Kelvin. So it's nearly doubling of transition temperature. One cannot argue that carrier concentration has increased, because even when carrier concentration increases, in this material the TC can never go beyond 35. So there is something else which is operating, which is, you know, pushing the transition temperature up and down. This graph tells you about normal state resistivity and various spin gap phenomena and so on. So this is another very striking result, that TC can be modulated so nicely by epitaxial strain. Yeah, yes. In fact, there is a detailed correlation between some of the hydrostatic pressure measurements and the amount of epitaxial strain. There is some good correlation between the two, even though hydrostatic pressure is much more complex. There are various other correlations that are observed. I will not go into it now. So this is the background. In this background, we will try to understand the meaning of these stripes and how they influence superconductivity, or how they, in a positive or negative way. So before that, we have to understand the nature of spin gap phase. See, this is some kind of generic phase diagram now, forgetting about antiferromagnetism. There is a depleted density of states for spin-like excitations in this region, so which you call as a spin gap phase. If you go into a Fermi liquid type of picture, as for example shown by photo emission, what you find is that quasi-particles are ill-defined everywhere, but they are better defined around these points, the so-called nodes. So it has in fact got the name nodal liquid. It's a beautiful form of non-Fermi liquid. So that's a better description in this region. So perhaps there are spin-carrying excitations here, and there are charge-carrying excitations which are elsewhere. Now, spin gap phase has incoherent singlets and unpaired spins going around, but the fact that you have good resistivity, very low resistivity, means there are holons which are coherent, which are living in momentum space. But however, electron has become very incoherent. Based on some recent experimental results, in fact there is a tendency to call it as a Luther-Murray phase, in the sense you have low energy charge carrying excitations in parts of the momentum space, but in that region in momentum space spin carrying excitations are absent, which is exhibited by this Luther-Murray model in one dimension. There is some truth in it. So this is the qualitative behavior picture for the spin gap phase. And all this interesting order, stripe order, seems to manifest itself in this particular region, and there is an interplay between superconductivity and stripes. No, I am. I will not go into that issue now. Yeah, one can actually, because it is in two dimension, you can think of them as fermions or bosons, depending on what kind of approximations I do. One can try to understand this type order in terms of them. I will not go into the theory of that now. So I mentioned this because, the way that spin gap comes is, basically it's not a real gap, it's a pseudo gap, so there is reduction in spin excitation density of states, and then it is happening at some characteristic energy. and the photo emission tells you that the amount of gap nearly follows the modulus of the dx square minus y square order parameter. So one brings in the notion of pre-existing singlet pairs, incoherent pairs, and so on. Now let me very briefly explain just this intrinsic superconducting TC hypothesis. It's something very simple because, if TJ model has any validity for describing this cupid superconductor, it's a very simple model. There are very few parameters. If you measure everything in units of T, for example, there is one dimensionless ratio J over T, and then there is hole concentration. So there should be some kind of universal function of transition temperature. If you have a single layer, well isolated, there should be one function. If you have bilayer, because of this possibility of interlayer pair tunneling, this dependence on X should be different, and if it is trilayer, it should be different, and so on. Now, if you take experimental results and look at the families of superconductors that are available, it is becoming very clear that if this hypothesis is true, that single layer superconducting TC at optimal hole concentration for this experimental number is definitely greater than 98 degree Kelvin, because mercury exhibits, one layer mercury exhibits 98 degree Kelvin superconductivity. Of course, what is the theoretical status? Theory is very liberal. It can give you 200 degree Kelvin superconductivity when you do mean field theory and so on. So it's not a good guideline, but experiment is a good guideline, which tells us that TJ model should have, you know, if that model is true, a TC at least greater than this. So we will call this as a lower bound for the intrinsic transition temperature. It's amusing that when you look at bilayer material, there are again families of bilayer material. The transition temperature ranges from 95 degree Kelvin all the way up to 128 or 125 degree Kelvin in mercury and thallium material. And similarly, there is trilayer material. So, essentially, is that if you had an ideal material with infinitely massive copper and oxygen ions, when there is no lattice involvement, where there are no external, for example, disorder, this is the kind of heuristic phase diagram you will have, but there are some other effects which is really bringing down transition temperature. One of the effects that you will discuss is the stripe tendency. TC, right. I will come to that when I discuss the phonon. Yeah. That is definitely also related to the stripe tendency and the stripe localization. Actually, when we come to lattice dynamics, it's very complex. It's very difficult to isolate out one or two factors. But, okay. Now, let me go into, very simple. So once you have these stripes, can they really provide mechanism of superconductivity? Let us digress for a moment and think about this mechanism propagated by Anderson. That the most important thing is enhanced singlet correlations in this strongly interacting fermion system, which is happening because of the strong correlation and this residual super exchange interaction. That is, every collision between two electrons with opposite spin leads to minimization of singlets rather than triplet, because two electrons with parallel spins don't have this super exchange, whereas singlet spins can have super exchange. So it is a system which has enhanced singlet tendency. So that is at the core of superconductivity in this particular material. So when we dope the system, we are basically creating space for the singlets to delocalize in a very heuristic fashion. So let us assume, because there are two possibilities. Either the holes organize themselves in some quasi-static stripey fashion, or the holes are behaving like an ideal gas, uncorrelated. Let us see what will happen. Now, the mechanism that Kibbleson and Emery and Zakharov are proposing is the so-called spin gap proximity effect, where the argument goes as follows. You have this or insulating region, which is a source of the spin singlets, then you have conducting chains. So if you have some amount of superconductivity here, it can be further stabilized by pair tunneling of electrons across. So this is their argument. Now, before I go into the details, let me go into this, then I will come back to the other arguments. The first important point is, if you take this caricature, and if you go do numerics in one-dimensional Hubbard model or look at various known results, a pairing tendency is very strongly reduced in one dimension. Of course, there is this one-dimensionality and hence singular fluctuations. Apart from that, this neutral singlets are the singlets that can delocalize along this chain to go into a Cooper paired state have also some kind of hardcore repulsion. So in general, the pairing in one dimension is very strongly reduced. This is seen numerically, as it is shown in many numerical experiments also. Now, there are also other instabilities. For example, if you look at the favorable carrier concentration for the stripes, it is close to quarter filling. So which is a near, which is a commensurate filling. So there are magnetism tendency at that filling as well as density wave tendency. Now, assume that, there is some superconducting tendency, and let me think about pair tunneling. Now, here one has to be, it's very interesting. The region through which I am pair tunneling is not a band insulator, it is a Mott insulator. In fact, pair tunneling means literally a pair of electron holes have to evaporate and, go to this region and then come here. In other words, what stripe is doing is, it is freezing the kinetic energy of the system, at least in this transverse direction, due to some energetic reasons, because you have a competition between J and T and perhaps some Coulomb interaction. But however, my electrons would like to delocalize in every possible, in both directions and go into some coherent state. So if you think of pair tunneling, that is, all the pair tunneling that are necessary in this gap energy scale, it is actually a quantum evaporation of stripes. In the sense, my holes will go into this insulating region and some holes will go into this insulating region. So establishment of superconductivity is actually pair tunneling between stripes. It is actually, in a sense, quantum evaporation of stripes. So this heuristic argument already tells that it cannot be a true mechanism. Now one can go further and argue
evaporation.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Quantum evaporation.
Why do you say it's a homogeneous to the electron-less
electron?
I mean, especially your electrons
are stretched
to the small densities.
Sure. I'll come. So, let us look at the superconducting state, for example, in IPCO, where what you see at the end, at the lowest energy scale, is a homogeneous electron liquid with 4-point nodes. So where there is no obvious 95-degree symmetry breaking. So that tells us that the system is trying to, at the lowest energy scale, go into a homogeneous quantum liquid. Now that means at that energy scale it has to give up stripes. That is our argument. Because superconductivity is delocalization in all directions. Exactly, borrowing from experiments also. In fact, I wish I could give some more theoretical argument for it, but so this is one argument. Now, having given this argument, now let me go into yes. There are domain problems here. Yeah, that if you have a single domain, in principle it could settle this issue. But, experiments can settle that issue. In fact, I also should point out, in fact, I forgot to bring this transparency. There is this beautiful numerical work by Doug Scalapino and Steve White, where this stripe correlations are shown to be very sensitive to band parameters like T prime and so on. So it is not something, while Hartree-Fock solutions and various other solutions do give low energy stripe mean field solutions, but at the theoretical level, by changing quantum chemistry, you can delocalize this stripe, these holes into uniform configuration. Okay.
How would measuring different integration depths settle the issue?
I think what Rajiv is saying, that suppose you really have an anisotropic superconductor with enhanced pairing correlation along one direction as opposed to other, you should see different temperature dependence of penetration as well as magnitude.
Yeah, but it's pretty obvious. If anything breaks the chemistry, you're going to get different temperature depth. That actually occurs in YBDL, because of the
right, then it becomes quantitative, whether it is due to orthorhombic or due to real stripe formation. Yeah.
But there are materials which do not have orthorhombic.
Yeah, exactly. Even in lanthanum copper oxide, I think with neodymium, I don't remember the details. There are some cases where this complication from orthorhombic distortion.
By definition, if you've got static spikes, you've got orthorhombic distortion.
Even in the conductivity, right. But so I think the issue is whether the spin gap proximity mechanism can be established experimentally. Right? That's what you had in mind. But see, the most important thing is the presence of singlets and their ability to delocalize in as much region as possible. When you form stripes, you are in fact holding the singlets into this MOT region. So it's making life difficult for superconductor. Okay. Now let me go into some experimental observation and then discuss why in lanthanum copper oxide the transition temperature is low. So my argument is that in lanthanum copper oxide the stripe susceptibility is larger compared to other material like thallium material, and what makes the difference between the two material. So this brings me to this issue of involvement of lattice, and this is a picture that you may remember that Loquet showed. That this is a very nice empirical fact that one sees in this class of materials, that if you take this octahedra and then look at the copper oxygen distance along the C-axis, there is a very nice regularity with transition temperature, and so this all corresponds to optimal doping, I suppose. So you have this kind of picture. Now, if you look at the copper oxygen distance along the AB plane, it hardly changes. Now, this is definitely, experiment is telling us something important, that if the octahedra is very strongly distorted, TC is going up. Let us see how it can happen. Now, here one has to bring in the notion of some kind of self-trapping of stripes, because after all, stripes are charge inhomogeneities. Even when I have a hole in a good insulator, the lattice can distort around the hole and then it can self-trap if there is sufficiently strong electron-lattice coupling. Here I have a situation in which there are organized holes. Is it possible for this string-like object to get self-trapped because they are, okay, I will come to the detailed dynamics. So in other words, what kind of phonons can influence stripe localization? One should also point out that, in fact, this was there in the discussion during Loquet's lecture, that one may argue that in lanthanum copper oxide, for example, when you do this epitaxial strain, what you do is you are increasing this lattice parameter, so you are basically walking up this curve. One argument is that as you do this, in a sense, you are pushing this transium layer also above. So any influence due to the disorder arising from this lanthanum transium layer is getting less. But if you make some, in a very simple estimate, that this small change, like 0.02 angstrom unit, cannot change the disorder significantly has to change the transition temperature by a factor of 2. So it should be something else. So as I said before, there are several kinds of lattice distortions possible: octahedral distortion, tilting, orthorhombic tetragonal distortion. But there is something which is very fundamental to this cuprate, which is this well-known Yanteller effect. Of course, in this cuprate, which is a layered material, you do not have really cooperative Yanteller effect, because the crystal is such that it has intrinsic anisotropy. AB plane is different from C axis. So the crystal structure and the constituents really break the cubic symmetry. So one should not be surprised if the octahedra is distorted. And that distortion need not be due to Yanteller effect. It can be simply due to quantum chemistry, packing, covalent bonding, ionic bonding, and so on. But however, let us go back to the physics of Yanteller effect and think about it. If I had an isolated octahedra, and if I am in copper 3 plus state, basically the two important orbitals, the EG orbitals, are empty, so I don't gain any energy by distortion. So I should have ideally a symmetric octahedra with the same copper oxygen distance in all directions. Now once I put an extra electron, that is by going to copper 2 plus, in principle, I can have a distortion, and the amount of distortion decided by Legend fields and various considerations. This is well worked out in the context of, you know, copper and many other transition metals. So the important issue is how much of the distortion in cuprates are due to this intrinsic Yanteller effect, and how much of it is due to external effects, like the binding in the crystal. I have no quantitative idea about it, but by looking at literature, one can say that definitely a fraction like 20-30% of the distortion can be easily due to Yanteller effect. But however, one can make the following statement, which will explain the experimental results. That is, having distorted is not a cooperative Yanteller distortion. There is something which is distorting, and there is this additional force due to this Yanteller effect which may further distort it. But if you assume the following, that if you take lanthanum copper oxide, and then if the curvature of the potential energy as a function of this distortion coordinate Q is shallow for lanthanum copper oxide and then steep for thallium material. In fact, one can give various reasons. For example, if you take mercury material and look at the neighborhood, it clearly says that the force constant should be different, it would be steeper there. Suppose you make this particular assumption, then it can explain some of these experimental observations rather easily. That is, in the equilibrium configuration, the octahedra is rather hard for C-axis distortion in thallium material and soft for lanthanum copper oxide material. In other words, the corresponding phonon frequency has this particular behavior. Now, when I go from here to here in the process of doping, what I do is basically I am doing Yanteller undistortion. That is, I am adding a term which is proportional to the hole. If one hole is present at that site, I gain energy by distorting, by going to going to less distorted configuration. That is the meaning of this Yanteller term. Which means, like in polaron, now we have this extended object, namely these holes which are organized along stripe. We need not go into the physics of why these holes are organized along stripe. That is actually to do with TJ model and large U-ness. But if such an object is there, you can very easily work out that you can have different distortion along the stripe. That is, if I walk along this direction, there will be Yanteller distortion here, and there will be less Yanteller distortion here. So I will have an equilibrium displacement which is like this. So this is like self-trapping. In fact, one can go further and make some estimates of various energies. So the stripe at this Yanteller frequency scales, being some kind of macroscopic object as far as the transverse motion is concerned, it can be very easily trapped if there is this tendency. So my argument is that in lanthanum copper oxide, if you look at the details of the phonons, because here I have assumed that there is only one local mode, but these local modes are coupled among themselves, so they will come up as some branch in Brillouin zone. There are very interesting softening which I have not clarified myself very clearly, which whose lattice dynamics is very different compared to lanthanum as well as thallium or other materials. So one can make a general statement that in lanthanum copper oxide, this additional factor partly involving this Yontaler effect, trying to remove the Yontaler distortion, seems to be strong. That is, this term is stronger and this frequency is smaller. So you can actually trap the self-organized, originally this kind of self-organized holes will be occurring at higher frequency scale or shorter time scales. Now you can really pull them and bring them down to lower energy scale. So it is a very simple possibility. And once you localize holes, then you know, superconductivity is very naturally reduced. Oh, okay. That is where the TJ model becomes important, because it looks as if, for example, in manganites, you have probably even self-trapping of holes in some region in the phase diagram because of this orbital degeneracy. And here, in the presence of this large U and in the presence of this finite T and J, experimentally it's very clear, I mean, there is no self-trapping of holes, because if that had happened, it will be like nickel oxide with holes, where we know that holes are self-trapped by Yontaler effect, and then there is no conductivity. In fact, theory does not exist. For example, starting with a TJ model coupled to Yontaler distortion, how Yontaler distortion with respect to single holes get renormalized to small value doesn't exist. But it's an experimental statement. Don't get this. You get lesser conductivity because you have, to that extent, you know, if I have a very few concentration of hole, to that extent this hole will become incoherent, because the hole motion at low temperature will be band-like, but then there will be a crossover temperature above which the hole motion will become hopping or incoherent. This is, for example, postulated in the case of manganites. These holes, as you approach the paramagnetic phase, become very incoherent, and that's why it is less conducting. In cuprate, you find that the linear resistivity continues all the way up to several hundred degree Kelvin. Oh, and when I said small doping, I mean about 6% or 8% doping, which makes it a metal. I agree with you, when you have too small a doping, then these complications can be there. There again, the kinetic energy gain, namely 3 times or 4 times T, is fighting, will fight against Yontaler distortion and localization. But here, once you have some self-organized object, namely stripes, its transverse mass in some sense becomes too large, so they can be easily trapped. Now, I will not go into some of these details of this calculation. But now let me go into another argument. Why do stripes destroy superconductivity or decrease transition temperature? Because here I have said that if you have sufficient coupling to lattice, you can stabilize quasi-elastic stripes. But how do they influence superconductivity? Here again one can give various arguments, but I like this very simple heuristic argument, which is the following. The fact is that we have a D-wave superconducting state with nodes, and we know that D-wave superconducting state does not obey Anderson's theorem of impurity, I mean disordered superconductor. That is, if you have an S-wave superconductor which is gapless, then small disorder does not really change the transition temperature singularly. That is Anderson's theorem. But once you have a D-wave superconducting state, things are very different. In fact, if you put an impurity, what it does is it in fact disturbs the one particle states enormously and then pulls out a mid-gap states, depending on the strength of the impurity, is very close to this origin. If one goes into the detail, it follows from actual, you know, interference between center of mass motion as well as relative motion in the presence of this impurity. So it really pulls out a mid-gap state. So that is why you see zinc affects transition temperature very strongly. Of course, there it's not just the D wave alone. The strong correlation also plays another background role. But here, for this purpose, we'll simply use a BCS type of argument. Now, if you have growing charge perturbation due to this slowly fluctuating strike, for some reason it is getting stabilized, let us say due to phonons, then whenever the frequency of that fluctuation is less compared to the gap energy scale, it will look like a quasi-static perturbation. Then one can find out how much is the density of states that is piled up here due to this presence of such perturbation. That is given by a very simple formula for D-wave superconductor. And then from this one can actually calculate how much condensation energy is depleted. When you do that, yeah.
I mean, aren't the holes that are forming strike the same holes that are giving superconductivity? And if so, why do you have the separation of time scale between very, very slow?
Right. I agree. In fact, the holes will actually go into the number of carriers and then decrease transition temperature right at that level. In fact, this argument is... No, if there is a collective order corresponding to charge stripe phenomena, then I will see some kind of self-consistent potential due to that locally frozen charges. That is what I mean. Mostly it is transverse motion which is at slow, because there are two time scales. Right, that which is an additional factor. But no, my point was to point out that any charge inhomogeneity that can develop internally at slow time scale will not be liked by a D-wave state. So this is a heuristic argument to find out some order of magnitude estimates. Yeah. It is affected experimentally. In fact, when you go to 1/8, it corresponds to that magic commensurability filling. Experimentally, TC shows very nice dips. There are various experiments. If you take lanthanum copper oxide with strontium doping, around this magic 1/8 filling, you do have a depression of TC. You can, in fact, bring it down by a neodymium doping. And various other. So here, you know, it is in a sense very simple because you are just freezing all the carriers, so the TC will go down.
I'm not sure if these are the experiments that used to where they had actually done different degrees of annealing on the system.
Okay, that could be due to this. Now, for example, in this region, where you have, let me see, so-called charge-stripe glass, the dynamics of this frozen charge-stripe can depend very much on the nature of impurities, because it couples to disorder in a very singular fashion. It may be something to do with this. Whereas in this region, there are very interesting issues. For example, in lanthanum copper oxide, one set of experiments says that in the superconducting state, like this NQR, there are no stripes, because in fact the stripe frozen thing comes like this. Whereas with oxygen doping, at least you see spin stripe even here, suggesting that there are background charge stripes. But here I just wanted to suggest that, you know, the fact that you have a D wave will respond in a singular way to this any internal inhomogeneities. I agree with you that this time scale separation is not very neat. So you can make a simple estimate based on this depletion of density of states, and you find, you put the numbers corresponding to some stripe order parameter value, and very easily you can account for a 50 degree Kelvin reduction in transition temperature. So from that point of view, the D wave seems very sensitive. In fact, there are other arguments which I am not providing here, that if you do a very simple BCS theory and then impose an external periodic potential self-consistently arising, and then ask how the D wave transition temperature goes down, it does go down very fast. Because what you start doing is, suppose this is the Fermi surface about the pi point, then if you have some stripe wave vector Q, what it does is, which is appearing as some external particle hole potential, some self-consistent potential, what it does is, it depletes portions of the Fermi surface corresponding to this particular wave vector. Now, if my pairing potential really wants strict D wave order parameter, once I have depleted pairing tendency in this region, it is as if it is getting depleted everywhere. So the TC to that extent very quickly falls to smaller value. However, one doesn't know that if I relax this assumption of D wave potential, I could get a D and S mixing and get lower transition temperature. But we know that the system, underlying system, does not have any tendency for extended S pairing. So the statement I am making is, stripe does not like D, then it may tolerate D plus S. And this amount of S mixing will depend on how much stripe activity is there in a particular direction. But however, this is expensive compared to D for a TJ model, as it is seen through numerical experiments and various analysis. So from all point of view, any externally imposed order will decrease the net transition temperature. In YBCO, there are definitely no static stripes. From neutron scattering experiments, you see quasi-elastic stripes occurring above about 20 millielectron volt. So, which is a larger energy scale compared to TC. So, I think from that point of view, I will say there are no, at least in the optimal doped O7 region in YBCO, there are no stripes. There are no quasi-elastic stripes. Okay, now I am actually coming to the close. So let me make some another important statement, which is similarity with liquid helium 3. Then I forgot to bring the transparency. There is a very nice similarity of the present problem and the present issue with the physics of superfluidity in helium 3 in the following way. If you look at the phase diagram of helium 3, the pressure versus temperature, you have a solid and you have a liquid here. It's a quantum liquid. And then there is a very small region where there is superfluidity. Now, if you go across this, this happens around 25 atmosphere. If you go across this point, the density of solid decreases by about 10%. Along this, this is like a first order quantum critical point, first order transition. So the solid essentially expands by about 10%. And then becomes a quantum liquid. Now, if you look at the theory of the quantum liquid around this point, or do I don't know in detail about the experimental results, and if you calculate SQ, the structure factor, you find it is very pronounced, exhibiting good amount of short-range crystalline correlation in a region which is very wide in pressure here, because it is, after all, it is a thing that has come out of quantum melting of a solid which has come to this particular point. So the short range, short time scale, crystalline fluctuations are definitely there. However, if you do any thermodynamic measurements or spin transport measurements, what you see is in this region is a very nice Fermi liquid or a strongly modified Fermi liquid characterized by various Landau parameter with a good Fermi surface. So, and this system does become superfluid at low temperature. Now, if I want to bring in an analogy, the issue is whether superfluidity arises out of the underlying short-range correlation. In fact, the issue of superfluidity in helium-3 itself is, I don't think it is settled. Now, there are old theories due to Anderson and Brinkman, spin fluctuation feedback mechanism, and other theories. By looking back, probably one has to reconsider them. But however, it is clear that the short-range crystalline correlation in this material, which can be very pronounced, need not actually influence the transition temperature. Okay. Now, in the present case, what is the comparison? What you have is a Mott insulator, which is analogous to the solid. It is a solid because of underlying periodic potential and plus this commensurability fact, there is one electron per side. Then you remove the electrons, you create holes. In a sense, it quantum melts. And the memory of the Mott insulator remains definitely through this strike phenomena and through this kind of anisotropic correlations. Unlike liquid helium-3, here the nature of correlation is very anisotropic. At the end, you find experimentally some, you know, two-dimensional superfluidity. So, to me, this example can be, you know, help us to make some of the high-energy features as something irrelevant, you know, which should be done in the process of renormalization. But when it comes to low-energy physics, like superfluidity and the establishment of a Fermi surface here, this may not be playing a very major role. So I just wanted to point out this analogy. So now let me conclude. Now there are some other things which I will not talk about. If the picture that I am presenting is true, there are many interesting consequences. For example, if you take lanthanum copper oxide with oxygen doping, which exhibits a maximum transition temperature of 41 degree Kelvin, under epitaxial strain, in fact, the TC should go to maybe 95 degree Kelvin. This will be remarkable. In fact, Lockway says that they are not able to do this kind of experiments because of their experimental difficulties. Going beyond 0.1 in carrier concentration and applying strain is difficult. So that is really frustrating. It will be very nice to see whether the how will epitaxial strain help, because when you strain this thin film, what you are doing is you are basically distorting the autohedra and then pulling the apical oxygen outwards. That means you are hardening that particular phonon, and then self-trapping of stripes becomes less and less probable. And this is another remarkable compound, which is isostructural to thallium-2201 compound, but it has this strike weakness, and its TC is only 33 degree Kelvin. Whereas its partner, which is quantum chemically similar, namely thallium-2201, has 95 degree Kelvin superconductivity. So, one should look for the stripiness in this material. Now, if you look at the existing transport measurements, it definitely shows strong difference from thallium material. For example, the Hall angle, temperature dependence, about which I made some statement. In high TC material, it goes as T square, and in this material, it goes as T to the power of minus alpha, with alpha around half. Because Hall angle is supposed to measure about how easily charges move on the Fermi surface. So this is already seen, but other experiments like NQR and some photo emission will be very nice to see this. Okay. Then one can actually go to bilayer material and discuss similar physics. In fact, there are some intriguing things which I do not understand. Because if you look at IPCO, because apical oxygen is absent in the apical bilayer, in some sense the Antler tendency or end distortion is not there, because one of the apical oxygen has gone to infinity. So that can explain for this 90 degree or 95 degree Kelvin superconductivity in IPCO as something close to intrinsic single layer value. But however, when you compare that IPCO bilayer with thallium bilayer, there is a 30 degree Kelvin difference. And what is that due to? Is it due to interlayer pair tunneling, which is somehow established in thallium rather than IPCO? I do not know. So there are many interesting questions that remains to be settled. I think it's very important to understand them, because this extraneous factor should be, you know, well understood before we get good help from experiments and test our microscopic theories. Thank you.
So this is a summary.
I showed it when I gave a talk at Brookhaven. So. Vic Emery was there.
I'm not sure I didn't point straight to find it here. Make it here. Shouldn't try to interpret it.
No, because stripes basically enhance localized charges. So make them difficult to move.
Minimum yard level. It is your natural experience.
Yeah, only the reciprocal action is taking the reciprocal stress.
So it goes in the right direction?
It goes in the right direction. It was too handy. I didn't want to.
Are you going to put a copy of all this on the web?
Should I put it? What should I do to put it?
You'll have to give a copy to the
secretary. I'll do that. This,
one. This one especially, I would like to have a copy of this one. This is very nice. Thank you. Now, perhaps I connect it with facial direction. Do you expect it? I mean, because it could happen that it's only the core interaction which stabilizes stress and that the system will like to stay separate.
Yeah,
but
I don't understand. It's not obvious. This is a microscopic, you see, this seismic phenomena is really happening in blackish parameters. Normal Coulomb repulsion in these phase separation complex, when you do photo, they take it. And you take two lanthanum water objects and create holes like vortex. You do create droplets, which is a beautiful example of phase separation.
You mean?
Metallic droplets.
Of larger size.
Larger size.
So you're saying that the Coulomb interaction will only stabilize the impact.
Yeah, this microscopic action, this scale, I do not really know how this can happen. Even when they see, you know, sites, it's not a hope. It is definitely bringing some linear correlation from the hole.
You know that stress or stress or stress, I don't mean to calculate.
Correct.
Then if you take the homogeneous and muscle into a mean field, then you have negative compressibility for sure. So you can say, well, the stripes are a manifestation of this negative compressibility, which will extend to take the system to a phase separator. So, and then if you fix the number of fibers, you will see a phenomenon. But if you have a very macroscopic sample and do the same incident, it could well happen that you don't have stress anymore.
But it is a domain that separates two magnetic orders. It's and not a domain that separates higher charges, lower charges. Like in a domain ball.
Well, you have higher charges in the stress.
No, but then it is not, no, normally a domain ball in a liquid gas will be. I will have faith, yeah, liquid.
No, I'm not saying that the domain separated by the stripes are the domain you would expect in phase separation. I'm saying that phase separation could imply that you accumulate charges somewhere and you distract, and you decrease all the reasons.
But, okay, so what I'm saying is
that in addition, there is the magnetic part of the
phase separation is the microscopic stripe, yeah. We are not used to that. Maybe it is possible. Because whenever we have phase separation, we
remember, for instance, in timing calculations, or everybody that you're dealing with a 40 by 40 like that, you know. So you wouldn't expect any macroscopic effect to show up at that level. So then stress is a natural kind of compromise between macroscopic phase separation and microscopic domain.
Yeah.
You cannot tell, I mean, from the calculations alone, you cannot tell what's going on. Very large phase separation is more stable. And the criticism not of the experiment, but of the calculation. A nice talk on very
I talked to yeah, I had a long discussion with Steve Wilson last week when I was in Stanford. It became clear to us where we were standing.
Did you like this picture?
This, no, it is not about you. It's talk about something else, but in
regular people.
Well, that's
kind of, you know, so nowadays, I think that we are outside there, and we're relevant to something.
Right,
yes,
yes.
What is the wise?
No, their point is similar to that. The sites are there, but they disintegrate from that. So they are saying that stripes are intrinsic to TJ models. However, they in general, to put safety sign terms, the one sign which enhances TC and reduces stripe formation, so the other sign which will enhance stripe formation and reduce TC.
that can be checked because if you send from holes to electrons, the opposite will happen. It's like changing the time of the time.
Right.
Changing the time of the time.
The lowest temperature that we can go to is really close to that is pushing,
which is, let's say, room temperature.
Should there be strikes at room temperature? Now, there's some evidence that, you know, if you look at the magnetic, so we're not even looking at the charge spike. Just look at the magnetic spectrum. So this is pi pi over here. This is T. The maximum is always at pi. Some evidence that perhaps the correlation length is decreasing, which you might think of as, you know,
the maximum
is always at pi pi, but as you lower the temperature, this maximum is getting shallower. Maybe you can take that as evidence that if you go to still lower temperature, it will have two sharper peaks. That's all. But we never see them peak, you know, away from this pi pi.
Actually, you can also calculate.
Yes,
on the compatibility.
That's what Bill Putica has been doing that a lot, yeah.
And does it become softer as the over temperature?
That depends on the T over J value. So his claim, Bill's claim is that when you have T over J of about 3, bigger than 1, then you don't get a phase of data by looking at it. His claim is that it only happens when T over J is less than 1.
No,
I'm not saying that there is no strike here. No, I'm saying it may happen at a very low temperature. And at a high temperature,
what is the scale that for you have come down to?
The lowest is about J over 5, which let's say is about 300 Kelvin.
Ah, okay.
We are really pushing it. We have very good results up to J over 2. It's very high temperature, above that. And then, you know, somehow doing some things here and there, we are able to. There is no Monte Carlo.
No. So they do Monte Carlo, they measure from the world.
That's true. But
and on top of that, they are
working. That's true. And on top of that, there is no Monte Carlo for the CJ model. Like, the only Monte Carlo that people have done is for the But I guess one.
LVO
was doing finite size. So we're still doing it, but you know, the thing that needs to be done there, and we are really hoping that somebody like Heinrich Roder will help us, is to really do full calculation of all the frequency moments. So far, you know, all that has been done is really just equal time correlation. But if you can calculate all the frequency moments, then you can start to reconstruct dynamical models. And then you can really ask, if we can go down to room temperature and have a full dynamical calculation at room temperature, that you can directly start to compare with what you know, because at this kind of temperature, you know, the dynamics should already be well developed.
Exactly,
yeah. the only calculation that I know of is Mark Gerald was talking about, and his estimate would be of the order of 100 Kelvin, but I don't know how seriously it's taken. I mean, his is a Hubbard calculation. Well, no, he's working with a Hubbard model. So he doesn't want to map it onto the TJ model, he maps it onto some kind of a dynamic and the series. Or dynamical cluster approximation, by the way. But it is two dimensions, yeah. So he's doing it for the two dimensional model, but using some of these.
So if you get like Fourier for the same range as the
That's right. So numbers of the order of 100 Kelvin, which is especially in the right ballpark. No.
But you would expect the top.
That's true, yeah. So that's why, you know, I would say that, you know, in his calculation it's not a constant power calculation. But apparently now what Mark told me is that if you just take the two-dimensional negative new Hubbard model and you ask how much is the Costas-Hallett transition can be used from, say, the mean field transition, it's only a factor of 2. I have to check that. Because there is this it's not reduced by a factor of 10 or something. It's only a factor of 2. So
something else. I looked again at your model of by other means. I applied the finger most of both informally. And that was done at all that
time.
And
the rotation is varied, yeah.
And I got except for a very special value of the happening in the center. I
don't
know if you finished that, but I think
see.
So it's going both an order of final temperature to be order.
Why would it become an order? So,
I don't know why there's a discrepancy between my previous approach and.
So, suppose when you say an ordinary anti ferromagnet.
What I mean at low K is it has isotropic 2 bands.
Okay. Well, what is the ordering pattern is what I'm. You can't tell that? From where?
All I'm saying is that in the language of the Springer boson, the question is whether you would expect boson expansion or not.
Right.
And it will happen on a zero temperature, and that is high long range of the
boson.
My guess is that as there are two regimes, and there is a threshold at which it goes from one to the other, you will get either one type of antiferromagnetism or the other.
Well, so we do have actually a spin wave type calculation where we actually argue that the order is something like this. You know, so on one chain you have an antiferromagnetic order. From one horizontal chain to the next, it's again antiferromagnetic. But then you ask, what happens to this chain over here? Because, you know, this is sort of in the middle over here, so it doesn't know which way to point. This becomes collinear. So, in other words, at the end of the day, what you'll have is, you know, parallel spins along this direction, and then antiferromagnetic along this direction.
Can I pop out of the thing?
Sorry?
What is?
No, the spin direction is rotationally invariant, so, you know, you can draw it any way you like.
But to both the horizontal and the vertical things were making.
Yeah. It's rotationally invariant, right?